Thank you very much. I was going to present just a little bit of PowerPoint, but I think I'm just going to show this and one more slide and then go into a chalk talk, because I think that'll be more dynamic and interactive. So,
right. PowerPoint is going out of style.
Yeah, get rid of it. I didn't like this in the first place, so I've been going kicking and screaming. I did want to put up the guys who did this, Aaron Hernday and Bruce Broughton. Aaron Hernday is a graduate student in my lab, and Bruce Broughton's been with me for 16 years. Bruce, I don't know, maybe 16 years or more. And these guys have done most of the work. And in the last year, Aaron and Bruce, and Aaron's done the predominant amount of work with Bruce helping out, have really tied the end of this switch up. So I think we understand enough to present to you so you can be thinking about the dynamics of something we understand in quite a lot of detail in terms of a switch between different transcriptional states. So why don't we just, maybe I'll show you one picture. We've been talking about these pili, and we're going to be talking about pap pili, the P pili that Tom was referring to. And I thought it was named after literally the P. So I learned something new today. I was amazed. So these guys allow E. coli, uropathogenic E. coli, to bind to uroepithelial cells. And I just wanted to show you this picture because it's actually bacteria that were harvested from a postdoc in the lab when I first started working on this. And the week she came in, she came down with pyelonephritis. Pussy kidney is what that means. And I had to carry her literally into the Stanford Hospital. And I, before she went in, I asked for a sample. A urine sample. True story. And then I ran back to the lab. It's not kidding. And this is the bug. And she didn't have exactly the one I was working on in the lab. I was really glad to figure that out, because that would have been really embarrassing. Okay, but we won't get into that. So this is the only other one I'll show you, and then we're going to get into the dynamics of the switch. This started the whole project, and when I started at the University of Utah many, many years back, I don't know how many years back, too many years, 18 years ago, we noticed that if we marked, now you can see those these large guys here, those are flagella. And these small little, you can see these are negatively stained with phosphotungstic acid. These little teeny fibers are the P. pili. And we noticed when we marked with colloidal gold particles, marked one specific type of pilus, that only certain cells in the population, this cell in particular right here, is making P. pili, but this cell probably not, and this cell definitely not, although it's making another P. pilus type, which is anagenically distinct. And this is a process that's been talked about already in this conference, and that's phase variation, changing between states. But what I'm going to tell you about today, and if I could have the lights, I'm just going to cut out a PowerPoint. What I'm going to tell you about today, well, let's see, how do you, is there any way to shut that screen? B, that's it. Thank you. Control B. No, just B? Okay. Yeah, that would be great. What I'm going to tell you about today is how P. pili switch back and forth. And I'm going to focus only on the core switch, which requires only a few components. And maybe if we get to it, I'll tell you a little bit about how the CPXR factor actually modulates switching, and it fits right into the switch model that I'm going to tell you about. So let's start off. This is different, by the way, than all other types of switches that have been discovered, in that it doesn't involve any DNA rearrangements. Okay, so all the other switches besides the P. pili type switch that have been discovered have involve some kind of a, I'll give you an example, a promoter, which is on an invertible region controlling, let's say, another pilus gene or whatever gene you like. And there are sites flanking this promoter that can recombine, usually with a site-specific recombinase, that allows this little region to invert. And now promotion will not be into the gene, and so you'll stop production of that gene. But this involves a DNA rearrangement, a mutation, a change in the DNA sequence, right? Okay, the type of switch I'm going to tell you about, we call epigenetic, and you've heard that term. We've talked about epigenetics before, and epigenetic means that it doesn't involve any DNA rearrangements, doesn't involve any change in the DNA sequence, and yet we're getting heritable states of on and off, on being transcriptionally active and off inactive. So let's start off. These are the bacteria. These are the P. pili. And they're able to undergo a reversible switch between on and off. The off are completely bald, and the on are always highly pileated. We haven't found any rheostat-type modulation of the amount of pileation. We haven't quantitated that, but we know for sure in the switch can be toggled on or off, but there could also be factors that control the level of pileation. We could talk about that maybe at some point as well, but I want to focus on the switch. So what I'm going to try and do today is give you a model and support for the model of how the off to on and on to off switch occurs. And as I said, I'm going to focus on the core, and here's what we're going to talk about. A global regulator, leucine responsive regulatory protein, we'll just call it LRP. Small protein, it's about 20 kilodaltons. It's a DNA binding protein and regulates a lot of genes in E. coli in response to carbon starvation, different carbon sources that the bugs have. LRP is one player. There's a local regulator made in the PAP operon called PAPi, which is a very small protein, which is not a DNA binding protein. So this guy is a DNA binding protein. It actually bends DNA. PAPi has no, you can't measure, as you'll see, it does bind to DNA, but you can't measure binding activity, so I'll just say no binding on its own. And then DAM for DNA adenine methylase. So this is a methylase that methylates GATC sequences, which, as Martin Marinus has called, the great GATSY. And what it does is DAM, if we look at a GATSY sequence, DAM puts a methyl group on, well, let's just draw this out. GATSY, like most of these target sequences, is palindromic, so that it's a palindrome, GATC, GATC, with a complementary sequence. And it puts a methyl group at both of the adenosines in GATSY. And it can do that in there's two chemical reactions, but it can do that without having to worry about whether this one of these is methylated. So the methylases that you and I have, those are maintenance methylases. We also have what are called de novo methylases, but the ones that have been mostly discovered and talked about have to do with a methylase that, when it sees a methyl group on this A, it will put a methyl group on this A. But in the case of DAM, if it sees a GATSY sequence, it can put a methyl group on both A's, just like that. It doesn't care if there's a methyl group here or not. So both sites can get methylated at the same time, unless this site is protected by the binding of a protein. And as we'll see, LRP and PAPi govern whether that site gets methylated by DAM. Okay, so the first thing that we did is to look at phase off and phase on cells and look at the PAP operon. And let me just draw out a little bit of the PAP operon. And I'll keep this on the board. And I'm going to be, this epigenetics, at least with this switch, can be a little bit hard to follow. So I'm going to be giving you certain things a few times. And we're going to come back to certain areas. And I'll try and stay focused on what I think is important for the dynamics and not get into the nitty-gritty data that support it. Okay, so the PAP operon that we're going to be talking about, we've got the PAPi gene, which is that little protein that doesn't bind to DNA by itself. And we've got over here the PAPb gene and the major pilin monomer A, And as Tom was talking about, there's additional subunits down here, including the E and the G and all those guys. Everything else is down here to make a pilus, the usher, the chaperones, etc. And the way the transcriptional organization is here is that there are, let's do it this way, there are 6 LRP binding sites, this isn't to scale, in the regulatory region, separated exactly 3 helical turns apart from each other, and we call those sites 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3. And why do we do that? I don't know. We had a good reason. All right. And there's a promoter here, which is the major promoter, which makes, we call it the pilin promoter because it's making the major pilin subunit here. And we did call these 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3 because the sites with highest affinity for LRP normally and without PAPI around are sites 1, 2, 3. And if we look at a cell in the off state, we see that LRP is bound at sites 1, 2, 3. And we know that a number of different pieces of data. And one has to do with the methylation pattern because, let's see, right in the middle of site 2 is a GATSI site, GATSI sequence. We call it GATSI prox because it's proximal to the pilin promoter. And there's also a GATSI sequence in site 5, which we call GATSI dist, because it's distal to the promoter. And so this GATSI dist in an off cell is not occupied by LRP, and so this GATSI site, if I can draw it like this, don't want to confuse you with, these are LRP binding sites here, is fully methylated. So I'm going to represent a methyl group by a dark box. That means the GATSI site has a methyl group in the top and bottom strand A's, adenosines of the GATSI. Okay? So that GATSI site's fully methylated because DAM is around, and DAM can come in and methylate that site. However, this GATSI site, GATSI prox, is non-methylated, fully non-methylated, because LRP is bound there. Now, we're going to talk all about the dynamics of how this all occurs, but we're just starting off, okay? We've got a ways to go. But I just want you to, if it's something you don't follow, let me know now, because it's going to be really important as we go. So this is a pattern of methylation, because it's a stable pattern, because LRP is able to bind to DNA and block methylation. We know it can do that. We take purified LRP and bind it here, it blocks methylation. And in an off cell, the pattern looks like this, because LRP is bound to sites 1, 2, 3, and not bound to 4, 5, 6. Now, why is LRP bind to 1, 2, 3? I don't want to get into the details, but LRP, for some reason, likes to cooperate with itself and either bind to this set of sites 1, 2, 3, or this set of sites 4, 5, 6. LRP is incredibly cooperative. If you look at the binding, you know, it's highly sigmoidal. It looks like that. Incredibly cooperative to 3 sites at a time. Yeah?
Now, is it correct that LRP won't bind? Is there a methyl group there?
Yes, but it depends on whether LRP is together with PAPI or by itself, and that's going to be the heart of the switch. So come back to that. Okay. If we look at an on cell, we see the converse pattern. This is a very symmetric switch. It's easy, once you get this in your head, everything is designed, I think, at least for me, for my simple brain, pretty neatly. So if you look at the on cell, LRP now, you see, is bound to sites 4, 5, 6, leaving 1, 2, 3 unoccupied. And we have a converse methylation pattern in which this GATSI prox site is fully methylated, and the GATSI dis site is fully non-methylated. So that's a converse pattern of methylation. Now, what I'm going to talk about today is trying to understand, this is the core switch, how the off state somehow goes to the on state. Why is the off state stable in the first place? Why is the on state stable? And how are these two states intercombined? So how does off turn to on, and how does on turn back off? Now we're going to focus mostly on off to on because we know a lot more about it. But we can talk about the model and how it predicts what should happen with on to off.
Can you say something about the range of switch frequency?
Yeah, thank you. The on to off switch frequency is the on to off switch frequency is 100-fold higher. Do it like this. Than the off to on. So these guys are not switching on very frequently. 10^-4 per cell per generation, approximately. It's variable depending upon the environmental conditions. This is a switch that's incredibly environmentally regulated. Now we're going to talk about the core switch, and I hope I have time, I'll come in and tell you how that CPXR factor impinges upon the switch. And we have a paper we're just getting together now with a lot of the data I'm going to present now. And the title of that paper has tipping the balance in it, because you're going to see that this switch is really balanced between on and off. A number of factors control that. And CPXR tips the balance into the on direction. And does some other interesting things. So the on to off rate is about 10^-2 per cell per generation. So it's about 100-fold higher. This is true for almost any kind of Pili switch. Pili tend to be off in nature, okay? Because they take a huge amount of cell energy to make all those structures. It can be 10 to 20% of the total energy of the cell going into making Pili. It's a lot of energy. And so cells tend to be off, which is why I like that sensor idea that Tom has put forth, that maybe if a cell, in the population, only 1 out of 1,000 cells is making Pili, and that guy finds a target, it could be a feedback mechanism that says, aha, we hit pay dirt, go for it, make more Pili, expand, conquer. That's what E. coli like to do. Ones that cause P infections, right? Okay. So that's the on to off and off to on rates. Okay.
Question?
Yeah.
Is there any demethylase?
No demethylases, unlike eukaryotes. Thanks for bringing that up. Now, I won't say that there aren't any, but we haven't found any. And you don't need to invoke one for the switch. It's a very important point. Okay, so I'm gonna jump right in here. Let's see I'm gonna jump into some genetic data. Ignore that for a second. That's a model. So here we go. We tried to understand the roles of LRP, PAPI, and DAM in switching. And something I can tell you right off the bat, if you make an LRP minus mutant, it's off. If you make a DAM minus mutant, it's off. If you overproduce DAM, it's off. And if you knock out PAPI, it's off. What I'm going to tell you today is that LRP and DAM and PAPI are both positive and negative regulators. All of these guys can act positively and negatively. And the reason for that is because we have two sites that they can act at. And one site they can act positively, and the other they can act negatively. So I'm going to walk you through this, about trying to understand the role of DAM, DNA adenine methylase, in switching, as well as the role of binding to these sites. So remember we started off, remember the off state has LRP bound to 1, 2, 3, and the on state has LRP bound to 4, 5, 6, right? If you knock out sites 3, 2, anything in sites 1, 2, 3, under normal wild-type conditions, obviously the switch switches under the rates that we just talked about. Fine. Let's just start with the wild-type. This is wild-type. And these are all going to be mutants that we'll proceed through during the talk. So in a DAM minus, you're off, and a DAM reproducer, you're off, meaning that DAM can act both positively and negatively, right? That's what it tells you. As a geneticist, you say, okay, it can act as a positive and a negative regulator. If you knock out sites 1, 2, 3, the switch is locked on. When I say on, I mean locked on. And a DAM minus, if you knock out DAM, this switch is still on. And a DAM reproducer, it's still on. If you knock out sites 4, 5, 6, any of these sites, the switch is off under any conditions. So let's just start with that. These data indicate that when LRP is bound here, it shuts off transcription, which makes sense because in the phase off state, that's where we see LRP bound to sites 1, 2, 3. And in fact, we can show in vitro that when LRP binds there, it blocks transcription. LRP minus should be on. LRP, good point, except LRP can act both positively and negatively. It's required to turn the switch on. It's also required to turn the switch off. So what's dominant is when you knock at LRP, you're not going to see any transcription. Okay? It'll become, I think, more clear, and you can ask that question again if it's not as we proceed. Okay, so if we take, remember the GATSI sites? If we take and make a GCTC mutation so that the GATSI site, instead of being GATSI, is GCTC, the C mutation here blocks methylation by DAM because DAM requires GATSI. But it turns out this mutation does not affect LRP binding very much, so we're specifically affecting methylation. The phenotype of this is locked on under normal conditions. And a DAM minus, it's off. And the DAM overproducer, it's more on. I mean, you're locked on, but it even gets more. It actually is probably some kind of a regulatory event that even upregulates it. We can see more beta-galactosidase activity with a fusion. So the point of this is this mutation causes a locked-on phenotype, whereas knocking out these sites causes a locked-off phenotype. Okay, we're going to come to look at this in DAM minus. It's off, though, meaning that even though it was a locked-on, you still need to methylate. We're going to just let me walk through this, and I'm going to try and this whole piece, you have to put them all together to make the whole puzzle. If you make this site GCTC, so this is GCTC prox, you get an off phenotype under any condition. So let's put these two together. This indicates that you got to methylate that GATSI site. Yeah, absolutely. That's the positive aspect of methylation. Remember I said it was a positive and negative regulator? We have the data. You have to methylate that GATSI site to turn on. That's what it tells us. But here, methylation of this site is required to keep it off. Because if you block it, they're locked on. So they have opposite effects. In other words, methylation of the proximal sites required for cells to turn on, and methylation of the distal sites required to keep them off. Okay, and these, I'm going to save those two for down the road just a little bit. So rather than keep it a mystery to you, because I'm going to just walk through this model once, and then we're going to come back to it. So let's start incorporating what we've talked about so far. We start with an off cell. I'm going to simplify it by not showing you all the sites. We're just going to show a single site, right? So when I show LRP bound here, it means it's bound to sites 1, 2, 3, for simplicity. All right, so you start off with an off cell. LRP is bound to sites 1, 2, 3, and methylation of the distal sites occurs. What I'm going to, I'll just make this conclusion, and you can ask me for data to back it up, but this off state is kept stable by two different things, and I'll show you a little bit of that as we go. The first is methylation of this GATSI site, back to the question that you had. Methylation of this GATSI site blocks LRP binding. So let me do something here. These are methyl groups. Just pretend that we have methylation at the proximal or the distal sites. Methylation of the proximal GATSI site blocks LRP PAPI, but not LRP, and methylation at the distal site blocks LRP, but not LRP PAPI. So I want to keep this up here. Again, see the converse activity. So I'm going to just keep that in mind, and let's march over here again. Methylation at the distal site. This is the distal site. Blocks LRP binding. We're going to bring PAPI in a bit, but it blocks LRP binding. That means that free LRP cannot bind to these sites very well. It's about a tenfold decrease to a 20, actually about more of a 20-fold decrease in affinity in vitro by methylating these sites. So that's, say, 10 to 20-fold. The second thing is there's a phenomena such that once once LRP binds here, it sends some sort of a signal down the duplex, 100 bases away. These are 100 bases away to decrease binding by another 10-fold. We call that mutual exclusion. It probably has to do with bending the DNA and changing the conformation because it requires DNA supercoiling to see the effect. So there's probably a structural effect. Don't know how it works, but that's a secondary effect. So what the role of methylation here is to say once LRP decides to bind here, the LRP then blocks any further binding of LRP by sending a signal down the duplex, as well as allowing this to be methylated, which also inhibits binding. So there's two things that keep that off state off. In our model, we haven't proven this part yet, to get a switch from this to an on state requires DNA replication. As you know, replication is semi-conservative, which is going to give you two types of hemimethylated. We call them hemi because they're half methylated GATC sites. One looks like this, and the other is the converse, right? Because you get two hemimethylated GATCs. This site, still non-methylated, LRP falls off, we presume, due to the replication machinery. And now we know DNA adenine methylase is required as a positive factor. I told you this site has to be methylated. I'm going to tell you why in just a bit. This site has to be methylated, and this is still hemi. In the presence of PAPI, LRP moves to this distal site and can bind to the hemi site because I told you that the properties of this methylation is that it still allows LRP PAPI binding. It blocks LRP but still allows PAPI LRP. So I'm going to walk through this again if anyone's kind of going, oh my God, this is complicated. Okay, it's not that bad. I'll try and give you some unifying principles coming up here. All right. And after another round of replication, this site becomes fully non-methylated. You can imagine that, right? Because if it stays bound and prevents DAM, one more round of replication, one of those duplexes will be fully non-methylated. And keep this in mind, this helps allow transcription activation. Other proteins are involved. We're not going to talk about them. Once activation occurs, the first gene in the operon is PAPB. There's PAPB up there. PAPB. PAPB has the ability, once it's made, to bind near the I gene and help I get transcribed. So it's a little positive feedback loop. So once the switch is turned on, once this occurs and LRP PAPI binds here, it causes a B feedback to I, and you maintain the on state because you've got PAPI LRP at a high level. Yeah? Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't get there. That's the I promoter, and this is where the B protein binds.
So LRP PAPI doesn't fall off during
replication? LRP PAPI probably falls off as well. And that's going to be invoked when we talk about going from on to off. Okay? So, all right. So, We're going to stop at the on here. This is taking it from on to off, which I will talk about a little later. Right now, I just really want to focus on this. So hopefully you can see kind of the basics of this, but this doesn't tell the story. That's not really the whole story. That's just a piece of the story. So let's move to the dynamics. What is PAPI doing to allow LRP to move from this set of sites to this set of sites? How does that work? Yeah?
Is the push that out of void up?
Oh. Well, listen. Thank you. Oh, I guess I have to push the bottom down. That helps, doesn't it? Thank you. All right. So what does PAPI do? What does PAPI do to help this occur? So I showed you PAPI LRP forms a complex here, but it really doesn't say anything about the dynamics. And why does this site have to get methylated by DAM? This isn't telling you anything about the reasons for these. I'm going to tell you the reasons right now, and I think we know most of them. Well, we certainly don't understand the mechanisms by which all this, the details of protein binding that allow this to occur, which are pretty amazing. Okay, how does this occur? PAPI has the property that it can form a ternary complex. So if this is the GATC sequence on the distal site, okay? And it turns out that same GATC sequence, so this sequence, C-GATC TTT, is a perfect inverted repeat at the two sites, the distal site and the proximal site. So there is an identical sequence that the GATC is within at the two sites, and these are separated by about 102 base pairs, actually, exactly, in many different organisms, many different Salmonella, E. coli, many operons that are regulated very similar to this. So this is conserved. I'm going to tell you right now the reason this sequence is conserved is that, first of all, CGAT is a recognition domain for PAPI. So PAPI will bind right here to CGAT, to both sites. And PAPI doesn't bind by itself measurably, but when it's together with LRP, which recognizes additional sequences that flank CGAT, and including actually the G of the GATC, LRP, this is LRP. Can't really see blue. Let's see. How about green? There. That's LRP. And what happens is when LRP is bound, and if PAPI is present, PAPI recognizes CGAT, not very well, but PAPI and LRP interact with each other. So PAPI forms bonds with LRP as well as with the DNA, forming a ternary complex. And this ternary complex is stable at both sites and increases the affinity of LRP. That's why LRP can move when it's when PAPI is present, can move to this distal site, even though it doesn't originally, LRP alone doesn't have much affinity for it. With PAPI it does. But there's a problem. The problem is you got the same identical sequence over here at prox. So if PAPI is present, what's it going to do? It's going to move LRP to both the distal and the proximal sites. So we've got a problem, because if you move it to the proximal sites, you're going to shut off transcription and you're never going to get a switch on. The key is methylation. So it turns out that when you methylate this GATC proximal site, methylation of that site specifically blocks, and it's right there, PAPI LRP. It totally, I mean, blocks means totally. Totally inhibits. When I say block, I mean there's no affinity of PAPI LRP complexes for a methylated proximal site. Not like a distal site, but the proximal site blocks PAPI LRP. So you can imagine in our model, once this site gets methylated and PAPI is present, the PAPI will move here and not here, because methylation prevents it from movement. So that's the role of methylation at GATC prox. And I'm going to show you I'm going to give you some genetics for how we know that's true. Yeah?
How does the PAPI LRP complex, how does it be the opposite thing on the nucleated and methylated proxy site than on the methylated?
Yeah. So how come methylation at the two sites can have totally opposite effects? I don't know. That's something we're trying to figure out. These sequences, C-GATC, TTTT, are totally conserved, but there are 3 out of 27 bases within this region that differ, and we believe those bases are going to help dictate the effect of methylation. So I could wave my arms and talk about it. Maybe Richard would probably come up with a better model than I would, because he's a better DNA protein interaction biochemist. Symmetric for both of them. Absolutely symmetric. Haven't done that yet. It's a little tricky because, let me tell you why it's a little bit tricky to do this. It's not impossible, but one problem is that within this region, the minus 35 and minus 10 sites are actually, so they're right here, they're right flanking this LRP binding site, which is right near the region that of interest. And so if you change that, you potentially could change, and we tried some of these mutations, you can change the promoter. So it's going to require a little work, but it's a great idea. I can tell you in nature, naturally, some switches work the reverse. Instead of PAPI being a positive regulator, which of course it is here, because you need PAPI to move to the on state, right? There are systems where PAPI is a negative regulator, and it looks like they've switched the two core sites. They've switched it so that LRP alone activates, but when you add PAPI, it blocks because you're moving LRP. What PAPI does now is moves LRP to this set of sites and turns them off. So, we'll talk more about that sort of thing. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's right. So this promoter here is a 400 bases away. Okay. Binding of LRP here blocks only transcription of the rightward direction, but when it blocks B, it blocks any further activation of I. So indirectly, it's blocking I.
So LRP at 456 does not activate I?
LRP at 456 can activate I, both indirectly through B, and it turns out, and the data that we have says we know for sure it can do it indirectly through B. I won't talk about the other, that's ongoing studies. Yeah?
How far is 456 from the promoter?
456 is about, let's see, site 5 is about 60, 70, probably about 150 bases. From PI, or for B, about 160 bases. And over here from I, probably about the same distance.
Is it noted, is it too far to recruit, or is it still possible to recruit? Does LRP recruit?
LRP doesn't recruit methylase. When LRP binds, it completely blocks methylation of the specific acid.
Do anything when it's bound directly.
It's not clear at all how LRP is activating. You need a catabolite gene activator protein to get transcriptional activation, and that's another story. And we actually believe that LRP forms a structural role, probably bends and helps cap contact RNA polymerase, but that's by no means clear at this point. Okay. Okay. This first step. Okay, this one here. Okay. Okay, so there's no replication occurring here. Okay, replication. Oh, why didn't it end up hemimethylating this site? It does hemimethylate, but there's nothing to block it so that, for about 10 to 20% of the cell of a cell cycle, any site that's hemimethylated will remain hemimethylated because the DNA adenine methylase levels are not real high in the cell. There's only about 100 molecules per cell. Just enough to methylate about 20,000 GATSI sites in the chromosome. This site will be hemi, but for only a short period, and then it will become essentially for that cell cycle fully methylated because there'll be nothing to block its methylation. It'll be like every other GATSI site in the chromosome that's not protected. Okay, so just to let you know, these are not natural sites, these patterns, there's only about 100 genes probably in E. coli that have a pattern like this. And most of them, the pattern doesn't control gene expression. I can tell you that right now. The ones that we've looked at, these are unusual. Yeah?
That's a very similar question I should have asked earlier.
Yeah.
In the second step on the same
path. Okay. Yep.
Second transition down one.
Okay.
Why do you get full methylation of the site on the right and not the site on the left? This is supposed to be stochastic, but sometimes the
Very good question. I don't mean for this to act. This site, hemimethylation depends upon the presence of PAPI LRP. So it'll be a competition of PAPI LRP and DAM. So when I can't show the dynamics, but we know for sure that I'll show you that there is a competition indeed that controls this, and the DAM and PAPI LRP are competing. And so if you increase the levels or decrease those components, you can see changes in switch rates. Now, I'll show you the, I'll show you that.
And so you're saying that sometimes you get the outcome on the left, sometimes the outcome on the right.
That's right. These are reversible.
And what prevents rebinding to the sites on the right?
What prevents rebinding to these sites here is methylation. Methylation prevents PAPI-LRP from binding. Once methylation occurs, it sets the switch because PAPI-LRP is blocked.
But why would LRP bind first before methylation?
Okay. If LRP bound here, you'd have and PAPI-LRP bound here. We know in vitro that's an off state. What I say in the model, this is what I would think, and haven't proven this, is that if PAPI-LRP binds just before LRP binds here, let's say if they're competing, mutual exclusion, remember, it works this way too. We could show in vitro that there's a tenfold decrease in affinity of any additional binding over here. And I think that's really critical, as well as, of course, once methylation occurs, that will set it. So I think it's a combination of those two. Yeah?
PAPI is expressed always, or is it just expressed on
these markers? PAPI looks like PAPI may leak a little, but it's pretty much off in this cell right here. In this cell, as far as we can determine, now we don't have, it's not as sensitive as I'd like right now, but it looks like very little, if any, PAPI is present.
So you only get a bistable situation where once B is expressed, it triggers on I, which then continues to trigger.
Right. That's right, and look, I want to add a point to that because I'm glad you brought that up. I'm just going to give you an overall way to look at methylation right now. I was going to do it a little bit later, but I think now is a good time. Let's take a look. If you look at the off state, LRP is the predominant species, not PAPI-LRP, in terms of what's important because of what you just said. When LRP is bound here, it blocks any transcription, so there's no PAPI-LRP around. And what is the role of methylation here? To block the predominant species, LRP. Why? Because it keeps the predominant species, LRP, from moving here. Because if it moved here, you'd be on, and the switch would be unstable. In the on state, the predominant species is not LRP. It's PAPI-LRP due to feedback, positive feedback regulation, right? What's the role of methylation of this site? To block PAPI LRP. That's a little synthesis of the way maybe nature designed the switch. Yeah.
So why can't you get in a state where both the disco and the proximal site are fully methylated and don't move anymore because
fully methylated because nothing's bound.
Right.
Good question. We've looked in vivo. Don't find a lot of those cells. Maybe a little bit, but most cells, if you look in vivo, so you look at a switching population, has on and off cells. Cells look like they're either methylated at GATSI dist or methylated GATSI prox. The state that you're talking about where everything is fully methylated, right, that will occur undoubtedly, but when DNA replication occurs, it will generate hemimethylated sites, which will provide the ability of proteins to bind. So that's a good question. I mean, it's something we'd like to do with synchronized cells and actually follow and see, you know, what the consequences would be. Yeah, for example, if we overproduce methylase, we're off. Overproduction of methylase turns gene expression off. And the reason for that is because now the time window of that this is hemimethylated is so short that there's no chance for PAPI-LRP to bind. Because fully methylated here will actually inhibit PAPI-LRP somewhat. Not nearly what it would do to LRP, but we know that if you overproduce methylase, this blocks transcription by methylating this site rapidly. Okay.
Well, since the site is asymmetric, does that mean there's a different state for the hemimethylated when the methyl's on the top than on the bottom?
Oh, that's a good question. We're getting into that now. We believe there may be a different fate. So the question is, if methylation of this top strand versus the bottom strand differentially affects, right, the ability of PAPI-LRP to bind, and it looks like it does in vitro, then maybe there's predestination of cells. In other words, one line is going to be more likely to switch on than another because we have a strand preference. We're testing it. Okay. Now what I want to do is move into a little bit of the data, come back to right here, okay? The role of PAPI was to form a ternary complex at both sites, and I just told you the role of methylation is to keep the PAPI LRP off of this set of sites. How do we know that's true? What Aaron did was to make a mutant, and let's see if I can get a reach up here. He made a mutant, two mutants. And he made mutants that we call T-GATSI prox, or a T-GATSI dist. And it turns out that that T, which should be a C, right? When you mutate that C, that conserved C, to a T at prox, it completely blocks the ability of PAPI to bind to the DNA and help LRP bind. Totally. It completely abolishes it and doesn't even touch the ability of LRP to bind. In other words, it only affects PAPI-dependent LRP binding to this proximal site. And the phenotype of that mutant, which is incredibly specific, only to block PAPI LRP, is, first of all, under wild-type conditions, it has a fivefold increase in switch frequency from off to on. But most importantly, in the damn minus, it's still on. It switches. So it's now independent of damn. And the fact that it's independent of damn means that the role of damn was to keep PAPI LRP off. Because if we keep the PAPI off by mutation, we don't need damn. Does that make sense? Okay. What do you think the phenotype of this is? This does the same thing. It blocks the ability of PAPI LRP to move here, but not LRP. What's the phenotype? Blocks PAPI LRP from binding to the distal site. Yeah, it's off, which is consistent with the model. So, all right. Now what I want to do is I want to talk about a balancing act. Balance. Bruce did some experiments to look at this balance between what Richard was getting at, the balance between DAM and PAPI and LRP binding and this whole thing occurring, which we can't really take a snapshot of, but we have to look at with genetics and biochemistry. And here's something we can tell you about the balance. If you take a GCTC dis mutant, what's the phenotype of that mutant? GCTC dist? If you don't allow methylation of the distal site, what happens? It's locked on. Great. Okay. If we take that GCTC dist and we overproduce PAPI, what do you think might happen to this guy? Now, I told you methylation blocks PAPI-dependent LRP binding here. But the fact that this mutant was up fivefold already tells you that that methylation doesn't completely block all the PAPI LRP binding, right? Otherwise, this mutant wouldn't go up fivefold. The reason this mutant went up fivefold is because even though methylation of the proximal site was blocking PAPI LRP, some PAPI LRP was obviously able to bind there and block transcription, because when we completely block it, the rates go up. So if you overproduce PAPI, it turns out you can overcome this methylation, because now, let's put it over here. Now what happens is PAPI is going to move LRP here, but it also can move LRP here because by mass action, we're increasing the PAPI LRP levels, and even though methylation here will be competing with PAPI LRP, it doesn't win. And now what happens is we get a switch phenotype in which we start seeing off cells. So off cells start forming because we're starting to move PAPI LRP in that direction, which normally doesn't occur in vivo, but we just increase the level of PAPI. Now, to show that that was correct, Bruce took this guy that had PAPI overproduction and he popped in an overproduction plasmid for DAM, and what do you think happens now? Now remember, this is a GCTC dist. normally, if this was a wild-type site, it would shut off transcription because you'd over-methylate. But it's a GCTC, so you can't methylate this site. So what site is available for methylation? The proximal site? And what do you think happens here? If we over, if this is correct, and this is a competition between PAPI LRP and DAM, it's locked on again. So that shows you that there's a dynamic, that we can force the switch one way or the other by simply increasing the, or changing the concentration of the different reactants. Yeah?
So
the
observable here is switching behavior.
Yeah.
And switch state.
Yeah. Yes.
And you see the expected occupancies of sites and the expected concentration dependence.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the answer to that is with these experiments here, we haven't yet done the in vivo methylation patterns, but we've done similar experiments with all the guys up there to look at the patterns of methylation, because that tells us where LRP is occupying. And we can prove it's LRP.
In vitro.
Oh, in vitro, yes, in vitro, with purified DAM methylase. Right. For these experiments, no. We have done that. We can do in vitro methylation analysis, and we can actually make the switch work in vitro. But for these particular experiments, we haven't looked. So you're right. I'm making an assumption here about what's occurring. But I think it's a safe assumption in vivo, these in vivo experiments, in that we block methylation at this site, and we have a lot of history with understanding what methylation is doing to LRP binding. But I totally agree that in vitro it would be very satisfying to see what happens, and that's something we plan on doing. Good set of experiments. Yeah?
Do you know what the concentration of LRP in the cell?
Yeah.
Expect it to be very close to 80.
Yeah. The question there is what's the free concentration, because LRP is bound to a number of sites in the DNA, and it regulates a lot of genes. It's a fairly abundant protein, probably about 10,000 copies per cell, I think, is Joe Calvo's estimate. What its concentration is relative to the KD. The KDs here, in the presence of PAPI, and Aaron can help me, I think it's about 0.2 nanomolar for the KD, 0.1 to 0.2 nanomolar. And for LRP binding alone to those sites, maybe a nanomolar, half a nanomolar KD. And what the concentrations are in vivo, gosh, you guys remember? That number escapes me. Ten thousand copies per cell, but the big question there is, you know, what's the real free concentration? Just like RNA polymerase, some of it's bound non-specifically to DNA, and yeah.
What is the role of leucine?
So this is called leucine responsive regulatory protein (LRP), right? This system isn't responsive to leucine. That's right. That's another, but that's a good question, but no, we don't have to worry about that. Yeah, Deborah.
Well, the GCTC sites, did you get, two different cells, some that were just always committed to the null, some that were always committed to the null?
If you did what? I missed the first.
Both the distal and the proximal GCTC sites.
Ah, make a double mutant. Good question. So make a GCTC dist and a GCTC prox. You're asking, what is dominant? Is the methylation of this, which site, and what would you guys predict would happen with a double mutant like this? Now remember, go back up here before you answer, and look to see the GCTC here that's locked on? What happens when you knock out DAM? So doesn't that say that DAM is dominant, you've got to have DAM? Well, what do you think happens now with a double? It's locked off, because this follows perfectly. This should absolutely follow this right here, correct? Because here you have a GCTC without any DAM, right? And here you have a GCTC, and you can't methylate, which should be identical to not having DAM unless DAM had pleiotropic effects beyond the switch, which of course it does, but those pleiotropic effects don't appear to affect the switch very much. And it does. It's a global regulator. Okay. And I think there's one piece before I want to take one more little teeny story that brings this whole thing full circle, and I think gets at the question, I can't remember who asked it, how in the hell does this thing work? Because I mean, I've shown you sort of how it works, but how does this work? How does methylation of this site block LRP and methylation of this site block PAP-ILRP? And that's the big deal. That's how the switch gets, that's the whole core of the switch, and we don't really understand that. However, in getting at that, I want to tell you something. Yeah. LRP or LRPI, but that has totally different effects on PAPI LRP versus LRP. And the reason I say how is that working is that these sites are almost identical. They're
It
has right here has converse effects. So methylation here blocks LRP mostly, and methylation here blocks PAPI LRP completely. In other words, there's totally opposite effects of methylation of the two sites on the binding of LRP versus PAPI-LRP. That's mysterious to me.
Are you saying that methylation of a distal site does not block LRP PAPI?
It blocks it at a small level. It blocks it, but not it doesn't block. It inhibits it to a small degree, but not nearly.
It inhibits. It's just the degree to which it inhibits it.
I could show you the data, but we're talking major degree, not twofold, threefold, many, many, many fold differences between. So when this is black and white. In the real world, it's not black and white, but it's still pretty darn good. Pretty, very, very different effects on the complex versus LRP alone.
Okay, so LRP PAP I on the distal site.
Yes.
Is not affected by methylation.
But it's blocked
by methylation on the proximal side.
Yes.
And in addition, LRP is blocked at the distal site, but not so much at the proximal
site. Right. Yeah. And the data is very, very clean for that.
And just the affinity for bare LRP of unmethylated.
For bare DNA that isn't supercoiled, there's only a twofold higher affinity of LRP for these sites over these sites. Only twofold difference if you cut the sites apart.
But they are asymmetric. I mean, there is they're not
identical. No, they're not identical. There's a twofold difference in intrinsic affinity for LRP without supercoiling, mutual exclusion, and all the other things that we talked about.
And the sort of thing in methylation is in between that, or as far as LRP PAPI?
We've looked at some hemi, but not under the right conditions. The hemi is where the story's at. That is a big black hole. I can't tell. Hemi is going to be intermediate, but there is a different preference for one strand versus the other. That's another story to come, but yeah, I wish I could tell you more about that. Yeah?
How long would it take to get infected until I have been switched on?
Don't know the answer to that. I don't know. Probably not over, I would think, from the moment you induce an expression, probably not over 10 minutes. Yeah? In terms of this phenomenon of I'm going to address that right now. That's my last part of my talk. Okay.
Hey, David, can I ask you one question?
Yeah.
So it seems to me like the what's rate limiting to go from off to on is you need a burst of B.
Yeah.
To flip on.
Yeah, either a burst. That's right. That's right. In the end, you got to have a burst of B. Yep. Unless PAPI gets activated directly.
Okay. It's I that you really need.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't understand what's right meaning to go to off. Why is going to off so much?
Why is it so much easier?
Is I unstable?
I is unstable. I is unstable. Actually, in vitro, it's highly unstable. I mean, it took us we didn't even figure it out. I took a crystallographer who I sent the protein to figure out after we failed to keep things more stable more than a week in the lab under any condition.
Is it unstable in vivo?
There's small levels of PAPI. So we have antibodies to PAPI. It's very hard to measure PAPI levels. Easy to measure PAPB. Hard to measure PAPI levels. A very, very small amount of PAPI. Now in a phase on cell, There's a lot more papi, but still not that much papi. You know, from going from, which I didn't get to, but going from on to off, I can give you some insight into that. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of experimental data because we haven't really analyzed this step of the pathway, but we envision that it also requires a DNA replication event, a hemimethylated site here, which allows LRP to bind, because as I said, methylation doesn't block binding of LRP here, allows LRP to bind, this becomes methylated, and you're off. One thing I can tell you, Tom, is that unlike the off to on rates, which are regulated by environmental signals such as CPXR, we found nothing that affects this on to off rate. It looks like it just occurs at some stochastic rate, and it's...
It could be that what's living actually is just dam activity.
Yes, and we invoke that dam would be required for this, and that's a really good question, and I haven't really explored a lot in the lab yet, but that's something we plan on doing. All right, the last piece, I want to tell you about something that I think, at least for me, is satisfying in that it addresses the switch and the model, and I think hopefully it will convince you that at least most of this model is correct in terms of what the role of methylation of the peroxide is. And that is, we started off many years ago, Linda Kaltenbach in the lab did a two-color screen, and I'm going to just tell you what it was really briefly. She took the PAP operon, hooked the promoter up, I'm not going to tell you what genes they were, but to give a blue color when the PAP operon was on. And she hooked up another gene, the ILVI-H operon genes, and the ILVI-H operon is regulated by LRP, both of these are regulated by LRP, but only the PAP operon is regulated by PAPI and DAM. It looks like ILV is just simply regulated by LRP as a positive regulator. And what she did is she mutated the LRP gene in these strains and found LRP mutants that could activate ILV, but could not activate PAP. Okay? How did she look at those? Well, purple colonies would be colonies where you'd have wild-type LRP that could activate both, right? Red colonies were the ones she picked, and those are the ones that mostly ILVI-H is on and PAP is off. And she got them. The problem was, we were looking for mutants that wouldn't allow binding to PAP-I. The problem is, these mutants, here's what we know about those mutants. Those mutants all fall within amino acids 126 to 134 of LRP. And what do? They bind DNA, both of those sites, identically to wild type. They bind LRP, or PAPI, beautifully. And they even can activate transcription if you put them under the right situation. So if there is an activation domain of LRP, which is still up in the air, they don't have any problem in that. So what the heck is wrong? We couldn't find one thing wrong with these mutants. Nothing. And in a lot of work. No. They're locked. They're either locked off. Right. So the PAP, based on the screen, you'd think PAP would be down. They're either locked off or their off-to-on rates are very, very low. So either they're stuck in the off state, you know, they can't get out of that off state, or, you know, they can't get into the on state. So what the heck's wrong with them? Well, we don't know the final answer to that, which Aaron and Bruce are working on, but right now the data look very, very promising that these mutants no longer recognize a methyl group at GATSI-PROX when they're hooked up with PAPI. Remember that PAPI LRP is blocked by methylation to GATSI-PROX. And we know that that's critical because if you block the PAPI-dependent binding here, they become DAM independent. Right? So these mutants, we believe, bind even to a methylated GATSI-PROX site, and therefore methylation can't keep them off sites 1, 2, 3. And if that's the case, it doesn't matter what they do to sites 4, 5, 6 because they're going to be off. And we're now testing that. So that's why we think we couldn't find anything wrong with the mutants, because they have a specific defect in recognizing a methyl group. Now, if that's the case, it brings up, and I think it is, it brings up the idea that the sensing of methylation at those two sites is inherent in LRP. Okay? So in other words, there's a domain of LRP, this domain, that is required to sense a methyl group. And it may be that this domain that we think we've identified that senses a methyl group here with PAPI LRP could be a different domain than the one that LRP uses to sense methylation at the distal site. What if there's two domains of LRP, one required when PAPI is hooked up to it, the other when LRP is alone, and that's why you have this differential methylation sensitivity? That's just a hypothesis.
So this mutant dominant?
Is that mutant, are these mutants dominant over wild type? Have we done that? Don't know. Don't know. We haven't looked at dominance. Yes, very, very good question. That's right, because you absolutely assume predict that they would be dominant. That's right. Good.
So you have taken the dominant expression or
so in other words, if you ever express DAM, can you cause them to turn on? Right? So you'd be looking at competition. We done that experiment? It's planned. I don't think we've done it yet. That is very recent. Very, very recent. Most of this stuff hasn't been published yet. We're just getting ready. Yeah?
I probably completely missed the point, but I'm still hung up at the importance of this differential
okay.
role of methylation
okay.
and the working of the switch.
Okay.
In the beginning, you sort of started by saying that it's very symmetric.
You're right.
In the beginning, I thought that I could see how it was working.
Yep.
You just have binding of LRP that protects the sites from methylation.
Uh-huh.
And you have methylation that inhibits the binding of LRP. Okay. So potentially, you have a flip-flop right there with two completely symmetric triplets
yep.
Of LRP.
Yep.
And so this will be sort of a nice symmetric off-on switch.
I'm not sure that would be so nice for nature to develop
okay,
that.
Nice.
No, because I think this asymmetry allows you to have environmental inputs so that it's right.
Right. So it would switch
right.
even in this symmetric form, you know, without PAPI, you know, without all those things.
Ah.
Just the pure symmetric switch LRP against DAM.
And there are switches
now, of course,
that, yeah.
You know, nature knows what it's doing. It wants an asymmetric switch.
Yep.
And so now we introduce another positive feedback loop involving PAPI, which is intrinsically asymmetric.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, yeah.
And that is tilting the balance.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then presumably this asymmetry in sort of the forward and backward switching, the limiting steps are somehow. Switching in one direction is somehow hung up on PAPI, and switching in the opposite direction is hung up on LRP.
Yeah. Let me just give you one little. With these mutants, that gets back to what Tom's question was. These mutants don't show any difference in on to off, only off to on. These mutants, the off to on rate goes way down or to zero, but if you can get an on cell, when you get an on cell, they turn off at the same rate. So this only affects the off-to-on frequency, not the on-to-off, which is interesting. It says that they are very, very different. What you just proposed actually exists in nature. There's a switch that an ex-postdoc of mine, Marianne van der Woude, works on, an outer membrane protein that only basically uses LRP type switch, but it uses this OxyR protein, which can compete with it. And so it doesn't have all this complexity, but it also doesn't have all the inputs. Somebody once asked me, why the hell is this switch so complicated? Why do you include, because when you put PAPI in there, then you make it sensitive to DAM methylation. Why? And the only answer I have for that, which I think is correct, is that nature put all these things in here because it wanted to be able to sense and respond to all kinds of environmental controls. And one control is the CPXR protein, and I'm not going to say anything more about it except to tell you that in the presence of, when CPXA is activated all the time, but a mutant like Tom talked about that's constitutive, and you make CPXR phosphate all the time, right? The CPXR protein has the highest affinity for sites, overlapping sites 1, 2, 3. And the phenotype of one of those mutants is that A, the switch frequencies go up, and B, they're DAM independent. They don't need DAM anymore. Why is that? Because CPX comes in and says, move out of the way, PAPI LRP, I'm competing with you, and kicks it off, and now you don't need DAM methylase to keep PAPI LRP off because CPXR is doing the same thing. And so that's why I was really interested in the idea that if you have a few cells and they're pileated and they touch the surface, this is Tom's hypothesis, that there's a feedback. Well, I can tell you one thing in that feedback is it keeps PAP turned on more. It turns on PAP even when DAM's not present. Why you'd want to do that? Well, maybe once you attach, you go, hell, let's make some more pili so we're really attached, and let's make sure all of our progenitors, all of our progeny go and make more pili. I don't know. Peggy. These are in vivo switch frequencies, but these are these are determined in vivo by the standard method of Bruce Stocker back in old flagella days, where you take an off colony and you grow it up.
I meant in vitro, in vivo versus test tube versus urinary tract.
Ah, you mean really in vivo? You mean in okay, okay. Have we looked at them in vivo? No. Haven't found any women volunteers. Don't know why. Yeah. We can do that. Yeah, no, that's a great question. What happens in the body, and how? What kind of environmental signals are being responded to, and what are the rates? Well, you know what the problem is. You can't really look at switch frequencies in vivo because the problem is every time that the cell makes a pilus, it binds. And when it binds, then you can't see it because you can't recover it. And so the problem is going to be bound. So if you're going to be looking at pulling urine out or whatever you're going to do in vivo, it's very difficult because you have a selection for those cells that are pileated to be bound. And so it's a really tough thing to do. Yeah. Yeah, in other words, because of this complexity, is it really hard to think about antibiotics that you could...
Well, I was thinking also that what DAM is a new way of regulating bacterial infections.
Right.
So is there any significant effect on how likely it is to be able to regulate bacterial infections through this mechanism? The mechanism is incredibly more complex.
Yeah. No. So for example, let's say you built a DAM inhibitor. You'd think a DAM inhibitor should shut off the switch, right? And this switch, by the way, is present. It's actually the major kind of switch that controls pili and E. coli. Most operons are under some kind of a methylation-controlled switch, or at least LRP control. That's something Mike could actually address as well, because Mike studies the role of DAM in Salmonella infection. I look at the complexity as actually giving us more ability to go design specific antimicrobials, like ones that would target specific parts of the switch. Because now that we know how it's built, we can really start getting into the details of what to do. Right. And John Perona here is working with me to get crystal structures of these guys so that that's where we're hoping to understand how this methylation works. So we really are trying. I'm not going to solve it as a geneticist. I know that. I admit that. So... crystallographer, do your work, and maybe we'll be able to figure that out. Yeah.
The amazing thing to me about urinary tract infection is the urinary tract is long, right? The bacteria is small.
Yeah.
And it's got to swim upstream.
Yeah. Yep.
Yep. You need different kind of pili at different kind of stages in the upstream voyage, right?
Right. Right. That brings up my kidney pie model. Because I have a model for why you want to switch these on and off in response to the host. If this is the ureter, so let's talk about the tube that goes up to the kidney. That's a long tube, right? How the heck are they going to go against a gradient? Well, when they're bound with pili, they're not swimming anywhere with flagella, right? Once they make pili, they're not swimming. And there's now evidence that the PAP pili and other pili are coordinated with flagella. And with a switch mechanism like ours, You can imagine a cell turns off in response to environmental stimuli. So let's say it's turning off. Once it's off, it can swim. And then, of course, it can go and give rise to on cells, which can attach. So by a process of phase variation, you can imagine they can release, swim, bind, release, swim, bind. And they're coordinated with flagella. It looks clear now that, I mean, that's not work in my lab. Other labs have shown that flagella and P. pili probably are coordinately regulated, provides a mechanism for movement, which is kind of cool. Yeah.
So basically, yeah, these bacteria are like going against the Colorado River.
Down there. Yeah. Depending on how many beers you had.
Yeah. And what I was wondering is that, have you guys thought about, so basically what we really know is between the bladder and the kidney, this is where these papillae are needed. Now, once they get to the target, once they get to the kidney,
right.
I'm wondering if it's your advantage. I can think of it both ways. Is it good to keep them on to stick there,
right,
or can it grow to a certain concentration and then it's summoning? I mean, you want to go on and eventually get out and infect somebody else, right? I mean,
right.
And so that's why we're talking about the different things, and you can do that by changing down levels, or you could actually modify the switch frequencies depending on what tissue you're in.
Sure. Yeah, and I think it's clear this, I mean, the fact that CPXR, cyclic AMP, and other factors control the switch rates that we know control switch rates, you know, I think it's clear that the bacteria designed a complex system like this so they can do just that, because that's the real world they live in, mm-hmm, for sure. Yeah. Wait, how many generations to... No, it's the frequencies here are, so 1 out of 10,000 cells per generation will switch in the laboratory, right, in artificial conditions under minimal media with glycerol as the carbon source, so that the cyclic AMP levels are fairly high. That's what Peggy's question was, what's the real switch frequency in vivo? I mean, we know that certain conditions can, like if you put them on acetate, which is a really poor carbon source, okay, they're really starved. And by the way, the gut, when E. coli grow in the gut, they're probably really starved. They don't grow at the 30-minute generation time. They probably grow at the 10-hour generation time. When you put them under those starvation conditions and the cyclic AMP levels shoot sky high, this switch frequency can go up to 10 to the minus 2 per cell per generation off to on. It can really shoot up.
And the ratio also changes to...
For the on to off? No, the on to off rate, as far as I remember, if all the experiments stays fairly fixed under any condition.
It stays fixed as a per generation number?
Per generation, but since many of you are physicists, and some of you I know are engineers, I got to tell you that the switch frequencies that I'm giving you here are averaged over, so we only analyze the bugs after they've grown into a colony after 20 generations. So what the real frequency is over time in a growth curve, we don't know. We're getting that data now with somebody on campus, Patrick Dougherty, who's doing FACS analysis on bacteria that have GFP reporters, and so we're getting into that. That's a pretty crude number. It makes a lot of assumptions, right? When you've just grabbed the bugs after 20 generations and then look how many on cells there are when you started with an off cell, that's not a very good... Yeah? I think the answer is yes, but I defer to the folks in here who are, that's their make a living doing that.
Viscosity, in a certain sense of viscosity, some not necessarily use.
But according to the UN, I'm trying, the people who get kind of infected are frequently those who have malformations in the region. So that means that that's patients without a film or with turbulence in the UN. So,
and old men have the same problem when your prostate goes on you, which most men in this room, your prostate's going to go on you. Then you start getting urinary tract infections. That's why older men get UTIs. There's backflow. They don't have a strong stream. And so these bugs can... That shows that is a really important antibacterial factor, is to pee hard. Drink a lot of beer. I mean, it's true. I mean, I don't. I mean, it's a joke, but it's real. Yeah. Yeah.
This is also probably a naive question, but to go from on to off, you need to not only stop making pili, but you need to get rid of the pili.
Oh,
bacteria.
Yeah.
And so do pili just not last very long?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the question is, you've got this beautiful switch and it's moving on and off, but if you can't ditch your pili and you're on, right, then the next generation, you're still on, right? And there is evidence from Stefan Normark's lab and others that pili can be jettisoned. And actually, Scott Hallgren probably has data about that. I haven't talked to him about that recently. Yeah, break, and they can be, I think they can actually be ditched as well.
So if they can they sort of conveyor belt their pili up the thing there without having to go off and swim and then back on to hold on again? Can they just...
Don't know. I mean, I've focused all of my laboratory's efforts on understanding just this switch. And the other part, you know, that's Scott Hallgren's domain and others that are looking at assembly. Yeah?
If you take a random sample of other kinds of switches, more or less complicated, is there a correlation between switching times and complications?
Great question, but you know what? Amazingly, so if you look at type 1 pili, which I talked about at the beginning, that have the invertible promoter, or you look at any other kind of, there's all kinds of other switches that involve a single base pair change, which alters spacing between the minus 35 and minus, all kinds of things happen that involve mutation. In almost every case, in virtually every case I know, I just did a review, says that the switch frequencies are really similar for off to on and on to off. They're not that different. Okay, they're in the order of 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 3 for off to on. And the on to off is always higher. And you know, they do vary, but this seems to be the most environmentally responsive switch that has been looked at, but who knows? There's a lot more to do. Any other questions? Yeah?
So to back way up, I miss what in your model says that 4, 5, 6 sites are essential.
Oh, why 4, 5, 6 is essential? Well, we know that binding to 4, 5, 6 is obviously essential based on the mutational analysis, and we know that LRP binds here together with catabolite gene activator protein, 60 base pairs upstream here. And we know that catabolite gene activator protein, or it certainly seems likely based on all our data, got to be careful here because we've got an expert on CAP, that CAP contacts RNA polymerase via a large loop, 215 base pairs upstream of the promoter, and we know it's phase dependent. And we think that LRP functions to bend the DNA, potentially bend the DNA, allowing contact of CAP with the alpha subunit of RNA polymerase. Whether LRP participates directly, I don't know, but it has to be at these sites. Whether it has to be bound to actually all three sites, 4, 5, and 6, is not clear.
So I thought you said that was a relatively weak effect.
A weak effect?
That LRP doesn't activate.
Okay. So that has to do with more here, where I was talking about the effects of methylation at those sites. That when PAPI LRP is bound to sites 4, 5, 6, and the proximal site's methylated, you're in a fully active state as long as you have cyclic AMP present. We can do that in vitro. We get really good in vitro transcription that actually parallels the relative levels that we see in vivo. And you need LRP, you need PAPI, and you need cyclic AMP CAP. And if you have those in vitro, you can get activation in vitro with sigma 7 RNA polymerase holoenzyme. Yeah?
The off-to-on switching risk, if you, and you said you have measured as well, but if you just sort of make a plot that's a function of some environmental variables, how sensitive?
The off-to-on switch frequencies, how sensitive, mean, how disparate are the rates under different conditions, basically? Well, if you change carbon source, you can have 10-fold or 100-fold changes in switch rates. I mean, if you go really crappy carbon sources. One last thing I want to just reminded me. This is going to take about 30 seconds. I wanted to show you one thing. I forgot to put this on the board. This is data we haven't published as well, but it's kind of cool. We put DAM under a regulatable promoter. So here we have increasing DAM levels, probably linear. We're expressing it on a regulatable plasmid. They go from literally zero, we can get no DAM, to very high DAM. And as you know, at no DAM, this is switching to on. levels, okay, relative levels. You see a steep movement as you start increasing dam, no switching, some maximal, and then a different part of the curve in terms of inhibition. No doubt, we're looking at GATSE-PROX methylation here, right? Because GATSE-PROX is required for switching, to turn on, and we're looking at GATSE-DIST methylation here. It's a different slope, right? So it'd be nice if, and I know some of you actually are working with me to try and figure out, can you model this? Based on the switch and all the parameters, if you could get all those parameters, could you reproduce this curve? Trying to understand, because this has to do with the dynamics, doesn't it? I mean, you're looking at dam competition here with PAPI, LRP, and LRP, and you're looking at all the dynamics, and this is the output, and that's what you see in terms of switch rates as you increase dam. We can do the same experiment with PAPI, can do the same experiment with LRP levels. And what I'd like to do is get to the point where we could work with people to model the switch and understand all these dynamics, put them into equations and try and understand, can we model and predict what happens with the switch? And that's something that is also ongoing, just starting. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.